What should Swiper swipe? In honor of Dora and the Lost City of Gold, what animated children's show that hasn't had a live-action adaptation yet needs one?
I'm Kitty Rich, and Doug was great and would be really easy to make in live action, and we need more coming-of-age stuff.
I'm Matt Patches, and I'm going to go, I feel like this is controversial, I'm going to go with Steven Universe, which is perfect in animation, but I feel like you could cast so many fun people, and it's such a big, like, Ursula K. Guin universe. I want to see that come to life with a $150 million Marvel budget. Fan cast that shit on our Twitter page, please.
Did you say Ursula K. Guin?
What did I mean?
Ursula K. Le Guin?
Yeah, K. Le Guin. It's all slur. I'm on vacation right now, and I'm cocktailing it up. Here we go. Steven Universe, the movie. Oh, wait, we're getting that later this year. Steven Universe, the live-action movie. Photorealism.
And I'm David the Seven, and in honor of Netflix's upcoming movie, I'm going to choose Invader Zim. Just you could cast a bunch of different-looking kids that wouldn't get cast in TV otherwise, like a Freaks and Geeks. And that worked out great.
Gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room.
Fine, I can hear you now, Dimitri. Clear and plain and coming through fine. I'm coming through fine, too, eh? Good, then. Well, then, as you say, we're both coming through fine. Good. Well, it's good that you're fine, then, and I'm fine. I agree with you. It's great to be fine.
It's a podcast.
Hello and welcome to Fighting in the War Room. It is episode 268 and the week of August 7th, 2019, which is Charlize Theron's birthday. What a day
Happy
in history.
Happy birthday, Charlize.
Oh, hey, goodness. We could sing that back in my day when I was a child. We couldn't sing that on television or broadcast.
Oh, hey, right. I forgot.
We're still not really allowed to play most of the songs we play on this anyway, aren't we?
Well, that's my attempt to try to get somebody to contact me about the rights to the I Love Lucy theme song, which I've attempted to do independently, and now I'm just, like, flagrantly flying a flag to come get me.
In the meantime, we're still here. David is on vacation. From all things I can tell, he's tweeting too much for being in Iceland hanging out with puffins. But in the meantime, Patches is going to read our reviews.
I am, and we have two of them, and they're both 5-star reviews, so thank you to people who leave reviews. I feel like we should probably know more about this. Didn't Apple just, like, reconfigured how they're showing podcasts, and this would be a good time for us to completely relaunch the podcast. I'm just saying.
Just cancel the podcast again. It's almost been a year since you did it last time.
Rebirth, The Phoenix Rises, but for now, let's just leave reviews.
That'll teach David to leave.
Maybe everyone should unsubscribe and then resubscribe to the podcast.
No.
Does that make sense?
Anyway, just read the reviews.
Here are two reviews. They're both 5-stars. The first one is from Mick1! Who says, the best! I found this podcast about 3 years ago by way of David Ehrlich's outstanding film criticism. That's surprising. He doesn't really talk about the podcast. When my favorite film critic died 5 years ago, I spent a few years trying to find a film critic that I loved as much. Enter David Ehrlich. I love this podcast so much, I even did a deep dive into the Operation Kino back catalog. Since David is currently rewatching Mad Men, the best TV show of all time, can there be a special Mad Men rewatch episode? No.
I mean, an episode? Yeah.
No, yeah, that's probably... I mean, this month would be the time for it. Like,
that's true. All right.
You have to find time to watch Mad Men. There's a lot of other new stuff to watch.
If you want to rewatch something, I hear there's another podcast about rewatching another great show from the aughts.
Yeah.
Called The Rewatchable.
Yes.
Thanks, Patches. You're doing a great job in the David slot so far. Retooling the podcast, then plugging the wrong thing. It's great.
Yes, The Storm... Lost. It's on Hulu.
You're on it this week. You're on that podcast this week.
Jesus Christ. You're right.
Oh, this week.
Gotta watch The Storm. Baby.
Oh, man.
Okay. So that's that review. And then we have a second one that says, first pod I listen to as soon as it drops. Been listening for a few years at this point and am now concerned I need to start having children to keep up with the podcast as it slowly becomes Fighting in the Toy Room. That is a really good name for our pivot. Relaunch. Love each host and the insights they bring, and I stand by Patches and thinking Aquaman was a great and fun movie from last year. Always wish Katie would speak more, and particularly love Dave's take on Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, and I can't wait to rewatch the movie with his points in mind. I've grown to appreciate David and his constant need to provide his thoughts on others' takes. Can't recommend the podcast enough and looking forward to future episodes. Hey, we can still get new people on board.
Yeah.
Oh, wait, listening for the last few years. New-ish people on board.
Join us. Leave reviews. Tell your friends.
We're pivoting.
No, we're not.
So we've talked about this movie before, but as promised, we are here to remind you it is now in wide release. So if you want to check out Lulu Wang's The Farewell, A24 has provided it to hopefully a theater near you, but it is wide now. We previously talked about this movie when it broke Avengers Endgame's record this year for biggest take per theater when it was only in, I believe, 4 theaters in New York and Los Angeles. Now it has finally finished platforming out and had a wide release this past weekend, which means not only did I get to see it, but Katie Rich got to see it.
I saw the movie. Ring the bell.
Hey.
Ding dong.
So we're going to revisit The Farewell once again, because it is an amazing movie. Definitely one of my favorite movies I've seen in 2019 so far, especially this year where my movie going experience of 2019 is, you know, I think lining up with a lot of the pop culture big blockbuster summer movies, and we all watched Stranger Things over like 48 hours, and we all disliked the ending of Game of Thrones. It felt like there was a lot of big, momentous pop culture conversations that I had to be a part of, and the movies I saw were either like at that level or were labeled disappointing and sort of like tumbled off. I was very happy that The Farewell came along when it did in this otherwise, you know, drought of, I mean, I'm sure if you like Hobbs and Shaw that there's something in that, you know, specifically for you. But I was looking for a good time at the movies, and I went to The Farewell, which was much sweeter than I was expecting, given the synopsis, which is a Chinese family goes back home when their grandmother is diagnosed with very late stage cancer, and they decide to not tell her. And the main character, played by Awkwafina, sort of struggles with that. She's a grown-up American in New York and is about our age group, maybe a little bit younger. Anyway,
I think they say she's 31 at some point. I don't remember where I got that from. But
excellent. Cool.
Roughly our age.
Roughly our age group. It's like a beautiful film to the degree that I know it is a foreign language film, technically, but it never feels like it falls into any of those. I'm trying to aim this pitch at people who otherwise wouldn't have seen The Farewell, because I'm guessing if you have been like targeting it, then you know it's come and you've already seen it, in which case, fantastic. We're going to have more.
Well, and Dave, I'm curious what would be the closest comparison that you thought The Farewell was going to be when you saw it? Because it was not totally the movie I was expecting, and I was very pleasantly surprised. And I wonder if I just like somehow got the wrong idea about it.
No, I guess I was expecting something more ponderous and slow. What movie would be like close to it?
See, I was expecting the opposite. I was like, I knew it wasn't Crazy Rich Asians, but I was expecting something like that, or like The Family Stone, but good, like something that's like very like straightforward and writerly and about like crazy family dynamics and all these relatives. And it was much more interesting and creatively made than that.
Why is it interesting and creatively made? I'm wondering if there's something specific. This is me going into editor mode. If you ever email me on a professional basis, is how I interrogate you. What is the actual thing that separates it from The Family Stone? Because there's Family Stone-ish moments, Family Stone-ish but good moments, I should say.
Sure. I think because it's not only relying on the screenplay to kind of give you the sense of place in these characters, it's just using filmmaking, like long lingering shots of all the crazy weird buildings in this city in China, and this like one extended take of a scene that becomes really important later on of the character played by Awkwafina, Billy, and her grandmother like kind of like forcing her into doing Tai Chi in the courtyard of her building, and these really little details and ways to use the camera that put you in this story in a way that I think a lot of movies that are like, we're just going to be about a family. Like a lot of movies can see that as an excuse to like not use a lot of cinematic right. techniques. And this one is so careful in the or way even, that it's made and makes you so invested in it.
Even taking deep breaths and something, I haven't seen this film in since January when sure. I premiered at Sundance, but I'm still thinking about this scene. And correct me if I'm wrong, because you've seen it recently, but where Awkwafina, she wants to smoke, right? And she actually...
Her uncle and her dad are smoking.
Right, and she doesn't, but she's going to take their cigarette too, right? Like, she smokes by a window in in her hotel room. And I just thought that was, like, a deep breath in movies that we don't get to see. Like, here's a really painterly image of Awkwafina smoking, and especially in more Western movies.
I think that's
we don't cigarette smoke anymore.
She saw like her grandfather, or like a vision of her. She was thinking of her grandfather and saw him by the window because he smoked. But like, I know that shot specifically because it does stick out as like you're taking this moment, and it's like, it's like green or jade, I want to say, with like a yellow light that's like letting the smoke curl in front of it. But it is something where it's not, it doesn't stop to tell you that she's having a vision. It doesn't, it's sort of the way Katie was describing it is like still having a lot of filmmaking techniques. That would be like some sort of point of view, like novel paragraph, but it's able to communicate that with like those little shots. But it's not filled with that either. It's not like Jean-Marc Vallée, you're seeing cutaways of relevant things all the time. It really picks its grace notes, which I think makes it more powerful, because I'm not sitting through it waiting for like another shoe to land. I'm sort of stuck in this same emotional jello mold as the family, where everyone is in a constant situation where they want to be sad but can't be sad. And it's not like a tense thriller terror where I'm waiting for, you know, someone to crack and yell to grandma the truth. And, you know, that sort of comes very towards the end of the movie where they have like a little mini heist. But for the most part, I think it's just really good at setting up mood. And I think establishing the family as a character without having to necessarily dig into either cliches or really too far into any specific character, because the performances and, like I said before, the grace notes are so well selected.
Yeah, and it does that with the culture too. Like you're this whole concept that like it is fairly common for Chinese people not to tell their older relatives that they're dying, which seems so insane to us. Like they do have to spend some time explaining that, but there's these things about the way that they go visit the grandfather's grave and they leave all these offerings, and like it doesn't really explain to you like what they're doing or why. It kind of like lets you get used to the idea that they're all like counting down their number of bows, and when they're all sitting at the table and they're eating all these different foods, you don't necessarily know what they are, but the way that they eat like tells you both about the culture and their relationships to each other. It observes, like it doesn't miss an opportunity to show you this family instead of telling you through the script, which I think is so rare for stories about families.
Yeah. Can I workshop something with you guys? Why do you think in terms of cinema, cinematographically, we're in terms of how it's shot, we're spending so much time with like key characters positioned low in the frame? But it's like
an example.
So like the Tai Chi scene, for instance, which is in the trailer, so I imagine we've all seen it at one point, is mostly played out in the lower half of the frame, and you get a lot of sky. And then there's another scene where Awkwafina is talking to her mom, and they actually sit her on the floor, but they keep the camera framed as if she was standing up, so you could see all these like balloons around her or whatnot. But with the eating scenes, sometimes like food, you'll be below the food, so food will be blocking parts of people's bodies as you're like moving around, which gives the illusion, at least for the dinner scenes, there's lots and lots of food. But it happens lots of times around the movie that I'm wondering if it's like we're regressing to be children, or is it specifically about when we're allowed to view the family from below or above, because there are some like cleaning and people doing going down hallways drunkenly or whatnot scenes that are shot from above. But for the most part, I noticed a lot of our key emotional scenes were just lower. Like we had a lot of
I feel like it might be something about foregrounding their surroundings, like the balloons in that room that you're talking about, or the food on the table, like it puts them in the context of where they are, which is really important both for the plot and also like this character, Awkwafina's character, like, you know, dealing with her Chinese identity and feeling like an American at the same time. Like that, I think that was where I noticed it without really realizing how many shots were lower, like knowing that I'm seeing the world. I actually don't even know the city, name of the city that they're in China, but
Changchun.
Yeah. Knowing the world of that city and the culture is there and present for these people in every shot.
Yeah. To add to that, I mean, I think there's thematic value in what you're talking about, Dave. But that on indie filmmaking level, there's just a practicality to like, we actually went to Changchun. We're actually in the homes of people. These are all real locations and we probably don't have to set dress them so much. Let's take full advantage and actually, you know, so much about indie filmmaking is about hiding everything because you're either in a cramped space or you don't have money to design things for your purposes. And here it's like, this is we're shooting in her house, right? This is already perfect. I imagine a lot of the cinematography is taking full advantage of stuff they didn't have to fake.
Right.
And there's some shots too where the camera lingers after the people have left the frame. Like you see the room at the banquet hall where this wedding is taking place and you can like people are out of it and you just like see the windows or whatever. It just kind of gives you a second to like sit in the world that it's in, which I think has a similar effect.
We talked about this before on the podcast where I had my two cents, but something I've been thinking about a lot and that maybe you all will respond to is just how universal this film feels and how necessary it is in the grand context of all the movies I've ever seen. I just don't have a lot of films that I've seen that feel like they're about grandparents or grandparental relationships. I'm just like racking my brain to think of anything that Nebraska. You know, besides Willy Wonka.
Nebraska is a father and son.
Oh yeah, that's right.
Nebraska has that age and that like cusp of life and death feeling to it, the last conversations. But yeah, this is
Moana.
About parents and not Moana. For me.
No, Moana has a really big grandmother relationship.
I know. I'm saying personally for me, Moana was, I didn't resonate on that level. I have been very fortunate to have all four of my grandparents in my life for a very long time. Two of them have passed many years ago. But, you know, I had very close relationships. Two of them are still alive. And that's so rare for a lot of people. And I've just never felt, I'm very close to all of these grandparents. I've never seen that on film in this kind of way where, you know, you want to live your life. You want to, an Awkwafina's character is trying to get the Guggenheim Fellowship. She's trying to live her own life. And she could have very easily decided not to go to China to see her grandmother. And maybe her grandmother would have died and maybe her grandmother will die and she will not be around for that death in the future. I think that's really powerful and I think it's really universal. And I'm wondering how you guys felt about the kind of grandparental relationships and this kind of odd thing that exists when you grow older and your grandparents do too, that you probably are going to be just having an average day when one of your grandparents passes.
Dave, you should talk about this.
Oh yeah. I lost two of my grandfathers this year and both of the times I think the stuff that you hang on to are like the good memories. So the farewell makes a lot of sense to me in that I've seen that masked grief that everybody's sharing a lot recently. And I don't know that I would have necessarily understood it if it wasn't like in my family, but I think this movie's very good in putting you in that place, but then also I think making a good case for itself that the movie does, that like the family is one unit and sometimes, you know, dwelling on the mortality of its, you know, elder members isn't necessarily the most joyous way to spend those like final moments. So I definitely enjoyed wrestling with the questions of the farewell, but I was super happy with how it ended that I won't spoil, because it allowed me to just continue wrestling with those questions. I don't think it comes down on a solid side.
And it also, I think, is it's smart and also makes for a better movie that it's about this grandmother when she is sick, but not ailing. Like, she is coughing, right, but she's like happy and enjoying her life and has no idea that she has this fatal diagnosis. And I think a lot of experience of death with older people is like a lot of just like a decline for a long time. And it can be sad, but also kind of welcome when someone passes away and is out of pain like that. But getting to like have them all spend time with someone while they're still well, like, I think a lot of people wish for that with grandparents. And it makes, you know, it turns a grandmother into such a compelling character and kind of lets us know her at her best and also gives her family members a chance to remember her at her best, too.
Yeah, I felt like she was really lucky. Like, my feeling.
Oh, my God, I know.
Like, you're so fortunate to get to do something that most of us only realize they should have done after the fact, which is talk to your grandparents. Anyone listening to this, I implore you to go talk. If your grandparents are living, go talk to your grandparents and ask them and to tell you their stories, because so few people do. I've been talking a lot about this to different people in my life, and I'm just like, we have to get the stories out of people. We have to hear what people's lives were like, and we never, and these people are afterthoughts in our own lives because we're so close to them. We're so in love with them. And I just feel like only after the fact do we realize we should have spoken to them more. We should have told them how we really feel and shared things. And like, that's what the joy of this movie is for me. Awkwafina getting to be so lucky to get to tell her grandmother these things and for her grandmother to tell her all these things in her life.
Can I just tell a story about my grandmother who died in 2012? We have this video of her from, like, I think it was Thanksgiving, like not long before she died. And she was like, you know, fine and lucid until the end, which is really lucky. But there's this video of her reciting the names of all the train stops, because her job when she met my grandfather was working at a train station in South Carolina. And so she could list the entire list of stops that the train would go on from Florence, South Carolina, in order from when she remembered it in 1944, which was amazing.
Incredible.
Yeah, she was great. Go see The Farewell.
Yeah, go see it. It's in theaters right now.
Think about your grandparents and call your grandparents if you were lucky enough to still have them. And call your parents, for that matter.
Call me. Leave an iTunes review.
Leave an iTunes review to your grandfather, Matt Hatches.
All right.
Okay.
It is mini segment time. This week, we have a whole bunch of little things that we want to talk about. None of them really its own segment, but we've each brought a thing. We're going to do some small, digestible things. I'm going to go first. Last night, I went to a Slipknot concert that also had a band named Volbeat and Gojira and Behemoth. Those were, I'm sorry, three other bands. And I went there because a friend's daughter, who I thought was 12, but is actually, I believe, 13, is really into heavy metal music, as I was when I was a 13-year-old child growing up in Colorado, and wanted to go. And her father, who I knew when I was that age, was like, I'm not into this. And so, because when we were in high school and I used to hang out with the father, I said I was going to turn his children against him before he had any children. I said, well, I'll take your daughter to Slipknot, with my friend Julian. And we said that in front of the child, and as parents of teenage girls know, that's basically like me promising over the parents. So as things happened, I got to take her to this heavy metal show, which is good. The metal community's strong. It's weird, guys, that like this band, Slipknot especially, I went to a Slipknot show, I think my last one was in like 2001, and I went to one like before that. It's interesting to hear what the younger generation thinks about our music, because she is like really into death metal for reasons that I was not into heavy metal at the time, but ended up sort of manifesting with us yelling back and forth to each other when each song started, if we knew what the song was, because I was very familiar with their first two albums and she's more familiar with everything else. Anyway, take kids to heavy metal shows. That's the thing.
Oh, I want you to take my kids. I know nothing about heavy metal, so maybe you will have to if they get into heavy metal. I just want you to take my kids to a concert.
Well, anything about you want your kids to go to a Slipknot concert?
I don't know. Like, I don't know. Your friend's daughter seems okay, right?
Well, yeah. First of all, she's fine. Second of all, if I've known you guys for like as long as possible, if I'm like, this can be accomplished safely and the child will have a good time, I feel like you could trust me. It wasn't my first Slipknot show, and then, you know, it wasn't my first time going to the Pepsi Center or anything like that. So
this is gonna make me sound like an idiot. Do they do mosh pits at Slipknot shows now?
They do. The one thing that I said is that if I did go, I wanted the capability to sit down, which first
because you're in your 30s.
You're an old man.
Yeah. First seemed like for me, but then once we got there and she actually like saw the pits, she's like, I've never been in general admission, and was like not into it. And I'm like, good. That's a whole other thing. If she wants to get into that when she's older, I could maybe still get into that depending on my, you know, age and joint level. Anyway, but maybe it's less of a call to the parents, let your kids go to heavy metal things. It's like more a call to these single people, or like the person who wrote a review earlier that's like, maybe I need to have a kid. No, everybody else is having kids and they don't want to do the fun things for some reason. So just take them off your hands and go have fun with the kid. The kid usually is like really into it, and then you never have to punish the kid. You just have to take it back to its own punishment den, and you're like the fun uncle. It's great.
Be a fun uncle.
That's my thing. Let's, since Patches is on a rant train, let's go with Katie before ending with Patches.
I'm not on a rant train.
I have a mini rant, which is that the Emmys announced that they're not going to have a host, and I think I have come around to there should not be hosts of award shows. It's too high risk for anybody to actually do it, because you're just going to get pulled apart for it, and inevitably one of your jokes is going to sink or make you look insensitive because Twitter is a nightmare. And all the best parts of award shows are usually just people who present and get up there and make a couple jokes and get out, like Will Ferrell and Kristen Wiig at the Golden Globes is one of the prime examples that I always think of. I really have a lot of nostalgia for Billy Crystal. I think there have been great Oscar hosts over the year. The Oscars, I think, are the thing I will miss the most of having a host, just because it feels like that's a tradition that they shouldn't lose. But I think the last couple of years of like trying to come up with Oscar hosts who are going to like make the ratings better, and then they fall apart. It's gone so badly that we at least need a lot of time away. So I'm going to bid a fond farewell to award show hosts, even though I will miss them. I think it's for the best.
Didn't Conan host the Emmys a few times? I like Emmys hosting more because it seems like people can jab a little harder and not.
Well, Golden Globes are kind of the ones like famous. No,
that's too drunk now. That's stupid now.
Too drunk now. I think it's always been drunk.
That's the celebrities having too much fun.
I say you go the full Sim 1 and just make virtual host, and virtual host could host everything. And then when it does a bad joke, you just delete it and you make a new virtual host.
I love virtual host. Virtual host, you're my fave.
Did you know that in 2008, the Emmys were hosted by Tom Bergeron, Heidi Klum, Howie Mandel, Jeff Probst, and Ryan Seacrest, all?
No.
It was a very big time for reality shows. Ugh. Tom Bergeron.
All right,
Patches, what are you going to rant about?
I'm not going to rant. I'm going to recommend. If you know me, you know that I continuously follow comic book things. We do it on Polygon a lot, but I don't talk about comic books that often on this podcast because there's nothing that really sucks me in that I'm reading every week. And I am officially sucked in reading every issue of this new relaunch, or at least transitional moment, I guess you might call it, for the X-Men series at Marvel Comics. Right now it's two books that's ready to completely implode, stretch, change the X-Men universe. They're both written by Jonathan Hickman, a kind of a legendary writer, and they're called House of X and Powers of X. And by golly, holy shit, that is some nerd ass shit, to pull out an old phrase of this podcast.
I think it's actually pronounced Powers of Ten.
It is, but yeah. Well, it's Powers of X, but the Powers of X is literally...
When you say the comic book name out loud, you're supposed to say Powers of Ten.
That's
Patches.
True. I'm on Polygon.com right now being shamed by our comic editor, Susanna, who says, yes, it's Powers of Ten. Okay. House of X and Powers of Ten. Why is the Powers of Ten? Because it takes place in... They use... what are those? What do you fucking
Exponents.
Call them?
Power.
Exponential number, yeah. To delineate... It takes place at different time periods. Present day, 100 years in the future, 1,000 years in the future. That's just the one book. The other book is setting up tons of complex mysteries where Charles Xavier has created a whole nation. Basically, the mutants are ready to stop like begging humanity for integration and are going full force against humanity. It's like, we are the new evolution of this planet. Goodbye. Fuck you. We know that every timeline ends with you trying to wipe us out. We're no longer a metaphor for the people, the marginalized who must be incorporated. We are now truly the evolved, destroy you, fuck you. And it is mind blowing to try and unpack everything happening in all these books. The latest issue that's come out, I guess minor spoiler alert, has Moira, the clat, Moira, is it Moira?
McTaggart.
Yeah, Moira Kelly is an actress.
Moira McTaggart.
McTaggart, who's been seen in like the First Class movies, played by Rose Byrne. Classic character. Spoiler alert for the second House of X book. Her superpower is being reincarnated. Like, she'll die and live the exact same time period. So not proper reincarnation. She's living the same life over and over and over again. Seemingly infinitely, but perhaps not, according to Destiny. another mutant. It's just wild. I think they're throwing... Hickman is just... has such a complex mind. He's using amazing graphic storytelling and, you know, these kind of like interpage explanation pages. He's using charts. There's a lot of charts in these books. And I'm just like, it's so geeky, but so thorough and really compelling. Just turning everything we thought we knew about the X-Men on their heads and going into a different era with this whole concept that is played out. I mean, it's definitely played out in the movies. If Dark Phoenix wasn't a signal of that, this is just, it feels like uncharted territory. Maybe I'm saying that as someone who doesn't read enough X-Men comics, but Dave, you have read a little bit of it. So what, or all of it?
I'm all caught up. Yeah.
Three issues out there right now, two House of X and one Powers of 10. The books tell you how this goes into October and there's one a week until then. And I'm going to read every single one. Dave, what do you feel?
Yeah, I mean, I like it a lot. So, Katie, let me try to angle this pitch more towards you.
Yeah, read the geekiest comic book I've ever read.
So, you know X-Men, right? They're these mutants, and then they're ostracized by humanity. Humanity sometimes builds robots to try to kill them.
Yeah, obviously.
So what this comic book posits is that the humans and the mutants have learned that it's true what Magneto's been saying. Eventually, humans are going to die out. That's a mathematical certainty. So instead of continuing this war between humans and mutants, where eventually the singularity gets tossed in and everybody starts to die, Professor Xavier, in his like infinite mind powers, has created a nation that cannot be entered by anybody that isn't a mutant, and is offering humanity three drugs in exchange for basically being recognized as a sovereign nation. One drug extends human life by 5 years, the other drug cures all mental illness in humans, and the other drug prevents bacterias from developing resistances. And so they're basically like, we will cure these human ailments and give you like another 5 or 15 years and not forcibly take you over, but you need to recognize that we're the powerful super race and you can't come to our planet.
Damn.
Yeah. So it's like, it's a change of what you think the X-Men are, in the sense that they're not this tiny team that's fighting superhero power or fighting, you know, superhero battles in like New York or whatnot. They're global wide. They're a country and they're a race. They're not a super team. So that's why I think it's going to be super interesting. Not only is it saying stuff like X-Men always have about the outcasts of society, but I think a lot of interesting things about governments and borders. So let's all follow along with Jonathan Hickman, who's going to tear it apart like he did with Infinity. He's very good at tearing apart the Marvel Universe.
I'm excited.
All right. Let's move on to segment 3, where we'll hear more from Patches.
Why do you want our movies to be better?
Yeah, let's start there.
Well, segment 3 is a true galaxy brain segment on this podcast, so let's just do it. Let's go there. I'm so depressed. I'm just broken up about all this violence this past week in El Paso and Dayton, and just like watching the outpour of reactions on social media. I I don't know what it will take to make change in the world. There's a lot of tweets. I'm not sure that'll do it, but you never know.
You're saying tweets are going to fix things?
Yeah.
Tweets
fix a lot, it turns out. But I've been on vacation, so I've had a lot of time to, well, chase my child around the beach and change poopy diapers. But after I do that, I've spent a lot of time just thinking about, like, what really creates change? And I've seen a lot of our colleagues be like, you know, our work here writing about culture is not as important as talking about gun stuff. And I'm like, I don't know about that. You know, I think the way we have to communicate to the masses is through this culture that we have, the things that we talk about, movies and film and television and web entertainment, and what all these things, comic books. This is actually how you reach people and change things. What I've been getting a little depressed at, and I'm wondering if you guys think that there is hope, is if there's room or you're seeing anything emerge from the current mainstream pop sphere that can reckon with these. I've been thinking a lot about global warming or climate change as well. Just like, here's, you know how they got everyone to be really worried about like the atomic bomb and the Cold War? They made a lot of movies, especially TV movies, low budget movies, where they were just stuff like death and destruction in kids' faces. And that made change. Like, there was a lot of widespread fear. And then people took action and begged for change. And we got away from the paranoia of that moment. We don't live.
What was the action that people took to get away from the Cold War?
I mean, it incited protests. It incited worry. People were more worried about nuclear fallout after the day after, that kind of stuff.
Sure. But like, I don't know that any of that is what ended nuclear proliferation.
No, but I think it incited the thought of people to make that change. I think that we saw more protest after that kind of like pop inspiration, if that makes sense. And that for when I think about climate change, I think about like we need more disaster movies, right? We need pop culture that actually entertains the, you know, we read long articles. Last year had that New York Magazine article that was just so devastating. Like, what if the temperature goes up? What if things melt? This is how bad it would look. I don't see movies really grappling with that, or disaster movies. I mean, we don't. It's a breed of movie that's just dying out. It doesn't really make sense in this ecosphere, and not a lot of big blockbustery mainstream movies that could contend with climate change or somehow reckon with gun violence have that platform, because it's not necessarily Hollywood's problem. I'm not saying artists need to feel the burden of this, but I'm surprised that no one does. And I'm surprised, I feel like music actually has more of an opportunity than movies and television these days. And this is where my real galaxy branding, I swear to God, I'm going to turn this over to you guys in 2 seconds, but I was listening to American Idiot, the Green Day album from 2004.
Seminal work about climate change.
Because when I'm on vacation, I'm listening to a lot of SiriusXM's Pop Rocks station, which is just 90s and 2000s era, when rock kind of was in the popular, you know, was the popular mode, as opposed to true like pop music as we know it today. That's when Green Day had this moment where they were like, fuck Bush and fuck the Iraq war, and we're going to make a whole punk rock opera album, concept album, that is just like, wake me up when September ends. It's about lovers torn apart for the Iraq war. That's some heavy shit. That's some crazy, crazy protest mainstream shit. And I don't get it from music, and I don't get it from movies and TV, which I think are too big to even begin to deal with these massive problems that you'd think are such large scale problems that they should be able to fit in the boxes that we've created, even in blockbuster engineered pop culture. But like, why doesn't it fit? Is there hope? Is anyone doing this? And I should be paying more attention. I'm angry.
The climate change, I feel like I'm on the record of feeling so much despair about that I don't know what to do. And I didn't read that New Yorker article or the New York Magazine article because I was so friggin' scared of it. I don't know that I buy that art is where this needs to happen. Like, I think I question your assumption that the fear mongering about the Cold War is what made that end, and more that like that was just something reflecting the fears that we have. And so many of the more immediate fears that we have now are about racial divisions and gun violence and things that like feel more immediate than climate change, like, which I think is to the detriment of us in the long run, but it makes sense to make art about that. What would climate change art look like?
I mean, climate change art would look like Roland Emmerich movies done with more verisimilitude and more urgency to say that like this shit is happening tomorrow, right? This is not exaggerated in a way that it would be like the whole New York just froze over in 2 seconds. Like
sure.
That's fantasy. But what's not fantasy is melting ice caps and like let's jump 10 years ahead in the future and see what scorching heat is like, or like what it, create a movie that's about hurricanes hitting our coast. And you know, actually we kind of got that with Crawl. You know, Crawl is maybe the closest thing we got this summer to reckoning with all this shit that we're dealing with, which is nuts, but it's been lauded for that reason too, a little bit. Not the most realistic version of this perhaps, but more than anything else we got. I do think fear needs to, and we kind of talked about this a bit when we were talking about horror movies and like why people need to see horror movies, even though they're fucking scared of them. People need to watch shit that scares them, or at least buy into stuff that they think will be popcorn entertainment that actually says, no, you're the stuff that you buy on 24-hour news and the rhetoric that you've that's, you know, brainwashed you. You need to snap out of it. Like, this is what it looks like. We've just used $200 million of special effects to show you what it really is, instead of being talking points with talking heads, right? Like, that's what movies need to do. Okay. But maybe there's not room for it, because Dave, before this podcast, told me a Marvel movie could never tackle these topics. And I don't get it. Yeah. Why not?
Yeah, because what you want is you want something that's going to help you and help other people motivate yourself and themselves to enact real change, whether that be political, whether that be environmental, whether, you know, et cetera. And that's propaganda. So I kind of think that to a certain degree, these things that you're saying don't crop up a lot because it's hard to do them like artfully and well. And I think it's almost impossible to do them to the blockbuster audience, because the reality was, if we had a four quadrant way of making everybody afraid of climate change, we would have done it already. I think like it's hard to. Music's a little bit easier because it has the capability of being like shoutable and vague, and it chemically, you know, will produce certain reactions in you, and just in terms of how the brain thinks about like rhythm and wanting to move and dance.
And it doesn't have to be literal.
It doesn't have to list out facts. It doesn't have to have an argument. It doesn't have to have a beginning, middle, and end. I think movies have to do all of those things. And if you falter on one of those things and you're like an idea movie, you blatantly become propaganda. And in a way that people are going to be afraid of you and or laugh at you.
You're either
early Michael Moore movies or later Michael Moore movies if you don't like do it correctly in terms of impact. But yeah, I don't think that like blockbuster cinema is the place for that. But what I do think is what's happening is cinema is echoing the emotional problems that we're having that makes you want this type of art. You know, we got Mad Max Fury Road. We got, you know, a whole bunch of horror movies about female trauma. We got Us that, you know, I definitely still read about classism. When we got Avengers Endgame, which I think was described in like an honest trailer on YouTube as being about a nation that kind of wants to go back and undo something that we did that, you know, kind of ended up turning the world real shitty. And that's one way of looking at it. But it's a vague way of looking at it that makes it about a lot of things and not something that makes it about Donald Trump, which I think you can't make a Marvel movie that's like the president's an idiot. In this real world that's out that you're sitting in watching us.
But none of these problems are like connected. It's not a Donald Trump thing, right? None of this is a Donald Trump thing.
Well, but it's going to be seen as a Donald Trump thing by people who you're making the movie for.
So that is the ultimate problem. And you're right, Dave, that like someone who would make this movie would be called a propagandist. And I guess on some level it is, because everything is politicized. So if you make an issue movie about climate change, you are a propagandist. But at the end of the day, like, okay, bring it on.
Oh, I mean, yeah, but the way through that I think would benefit all of us and would be a lot easier to execute by hopefully a lot of people is you make art to build empathy bridges. You make art to feel somebody else's pain, happiness, whatever. Then you're lifting up like different voices. You're telling people about, you know, I don't live anywhere that's going to get flooded by climate change, so I don't give a fuck. But that, you know, I don't know how many wild boars charge at children in certain parts of the United States. Obviously, I learned this week. But I think using art to make something like the farewell, or to make an empathy machine, to make a cross-cultural or just a cross-personal empathy machine, leads to the solutions, hopefully, in the correct pathways. If you want a legislative solution to gun violence, you don't want a movie that proves guns are bad because they, like, having the Punisher, you know, just gets all, like, tangled up and, like, everything, movies cause violence. I think it would be weird to do that, to have both arguments and being like, I could make a movie that's anti-gun, but violence movies don't cause violence. Yes, scientifically, you might be able to make that argument. I don't think that's an argument that wins anybody's hearts and minds.
I also think about the power that art and movies and even like TV shows and YouTube channels or whatever have to change things by shifting norms. Like the idea that you can just start having all of your most admirable characters in movies using reusable bags instead of plastic bags for shopping, and that can reduce plastic bag usage, or that like YouTube influencers like stop drinking bottled water, and then like people, like that becomes less cool. Like the idea of setting the standards, not for like what you believe politically, but like what is desirable, and that like vegetarianism could be promoted more, like all of these smaller things, specifically about climate, because I think there's elements of just like waste and reuse that I think can be a little bit more depoliticized. Like I think that's right. A kind of like it's like a soft power thing. It's like how America sold Coca-Cola and convertibles and burger and like hamburgers at diners to the world in the 50s. Like movies still have the power to do that, I think.
Yeah, well, two things. One, I think the hard thing is when certain issues don't have people like definitively attached to them. Something like climate change is difficult, and gun violence is too, because it's like so abstract, and the people are so random and radicalized in the nether regions of the internet. Like there's not a palpable source for the problem, and that means it's harder to characterize, as opposed to something like you know, police violence against Black Americans. I feel like that's something that's really emerged in the art and craft of American cinema over the last few years, especially mainstream. You know, we had something like Widows, which had a really kind of unexpected turn into that theme. And I'm really excited to see Queen and Slim, this Melina Matsoukas movie from Universal Pictures, big studio movie, looks really artful and cool and explores that topic. Like that's something that has characters attached to it. You can instigate an arc of, you know, a 90-minute ride through some, you know, an incident like that. And climate change and gun violence and these big topics, things that we need to jump. I mean, how do you pin that to something specific? Yeah, maybe, you know, Katie, you kind of brushed up against this, and you would be an expert more than me here, but like maybe these are issues that cannot be tackled in pop culture in the media sense, but in the celebrity sense. We cannot talk about big picture issues in our stories at this point in this part of modern history, but our celebrity voices can. And unfortunately, that's a bit muddled. If you follow YouTube drama, if you follow some of these big name YouTube people, like some of these people have tackled these issues head on for millions and millions of people, but they do it in a way that's also trying to, you know, rev the engines of their YouTube page or get clicks. And it's like, it's the true modern media, you know, paradox. It's just madness to see what celebs in the YouTube space do to important issues. If you've watched Logan Paul's gun violence documentary Holy hell.
What Logan is wrong Paul with you? Has a gun violence documentary?
Highly recommend.
God. Lord.
No. I went to Florida and did some conversations with Marco Rubio. It was just a nightmare. But this is what people want to dip their toes into these issues because they know they're clicky and they know people want to talk about them. But that's another way they're muddled. But maybe celebrities, this is why music comes up more. Like American Idiot could emerge as a mainstream album, huge, became a Broadway show. And that was a protest album. That's a big fuck you to George Bush. I don't see that happening now in the music space, but I guess music celebrities still have that political.
Yeah. Do you know who started the Feral Hogs thing? It was Jason Isbell.
Yeah. No, I think it.
Not on purpose.
Not on purpose.
It just shifted to music you're not listening to, but like a fucking Kid Rock made a Trump's an Asshole album, everybody would pay attention.
Right. If he did that, people would pay attention, but they don't do that. I mean, we would know.
Kanye could.
Kanye
sure,
could.
These people could do that. That's what frustrates me, that people could do have the platform to do that. And some of these artists have.
They like Trump.
But like, do you need like a Bruce Springsteen anti-Trump album? Like,
I think the country does.
Don't
actually.
Really?
I think the country does. Not an anti-Trump. I'm not talking about anti-Trump here. I'm not talking about that, like, polarizing. I'm talking about big issues here. I'm talking about moving beyond the talking points of like the circus and the 24-hour news, the infotainment aspect of this, which is where Trump land is and where all these conversations wind up getting stuck in the mud. I do think we need a Bruce Springsteen album being like, a fucking levee's broke, you know?
Sure.
That's what we need. And it needs to have his like post 9/11, but like pre-disaster, right? Like, we need something inspirational here, boss. I think that is what we need. But can you imagine it? And from who? And it has to be for the young people.
That's,
to bring it all the way back. Like, when we talk about the day of, like, these nuke paranoia thrillers, even if they were low-budget TV movies, they were instilling fear in young people who grew up and were like, we can't just have nukes laying around. Like, we can't do this.
Well, that's why I'm talking about, like, YouTube influencers. Like, I think Marvel movies have power over young people, but they also are trying to reach a global audience, and they're just never going to do something that's going to, like, alienate China, much less, like, half of America. But I think young people are tuned in to people who have a lot of ability to get political and get specific and kind of model behaviors that movies don't necessarily have the time to get into. And I don't know. I've got faith that can happen there and probably is already happening there.
We're young.
My yeah. sister and her husband went vegan after watching two Netflix documentaries.
Whoa.
They the did.
Streaming.
I feel yeah. like what you might be missing out on is just like the huge like American-wide recognized piece of pop culture, because what Katie just said made me think that, like, yeah, this is probably all community specific. Like, what you're looking for probably exists. It's just not wherever you're hanging out on the internet or in life. I don't know.
That's not an answer, because that means it's not actually reaching the masses. Like, yeah, I'm sure.
I'm sure it is reaching the masses. It's just not one thing that's reaching. It's not art. The idea is there, I think. It's easier, I would say, that now to spread an idea without art than it was in 1992, or even worse, in like 1976.
So maybe that's the problem.
It's the problem in terms of producing like gigantic, big, like, why are there not movies that are dealing with like big climate change things? Because they're just trying to get people to come to the movies. They're losing that. They're not king of the entertainment like world anymore. Like, I guess, like, another question, or a question that I would lead off of is, in terms of entertainment, like, we're seeing all this upheaval and how, like, the NFL and owners and shit handle themselves because people are watching that all the time and because that's where the, you know, huge conversation could take place.
Right.
But I think, you know, that's a niche that I'm not in. But I think, like, if you were to follow that down to YouTubers, to people who do podcasts, to forum moderators or whatnot, I bet a lot of these people are looking for that thing that you're looking for and find it for their community. I don't know. It always like amazes me that I find fellow people randomly that still listen to like Dan Harmon's podcast that's been going on for like years and years. And it's like, it's this little tight group of community that, like, every other week you'll find somebody that's making the same fucking in-joke about, like, mass removal of bees. And you'll be like, oh yeah, that community exists. And they have their, you know, solution art and episodes, I think. You could put a lot of Rick and Morty parallels to a lot of stuff, so...
Well, yeah, we see the horrible version of this with, like, you know, 8chan, like, channels that are promoting horribly toxic things, but there are, I believe, many, many more positive versions of that, yeah. Or at least that's welcoming right. And I not think,
if you can get every Rick and Morty fan to line up for Szechuan sauce.
Yeah, seriously.
Why can't you get every Rick and Morty fan to fucking, like, protest something important?
You could. There's just that amount of, like, however millions of people that went out and, you know, protest Trump, or the people in, like, Hong Kong that are protesting now, those pop up for localized individual communities. I guess, okay, everything I said is basically applying it to if you want to, like, change somebody's mind in terms of, like, politics, in terms of capitalism, in terms of class, specifically climate change, you might have an argument there. There should be a way. I said if there was a way, we'd find it, but maybe we should still be striving for that way, because it is something like The Day After Tomorrow, where you could show literally everybody in the world dying from this if you extended that out to, like, make it a threat. Maybe that's the one place your hope is.
Here's my pitch to wrap it up. Netflix, if you're listening, Bright 2, Will Smith versus the weather.
Oh my God.
The fantasy weather, but it's still real. It's still gritty on the streets.
And then he has to stab Elsa through the heart. It's not Elsa because you're getting contract things, but it's the Snow Queen, and we all know who she is.
And then Disney Plus sues. That'd be fun to watch.
As long as the movie's in the mainstream, the battle would be worth
it. That does it for this week's episode. We'll be back next week. David should be back, right? Unless he decides to stay in Iceland, who could blame him? In the meantime, tell the people who you are.
I'm Matt Patches, senior editor at Polygon, which, because I'm on vacation, is not filled with my rants. So maybe go there and enjoy life. I'm on Twitter at Mr. Patches. We have a website, fightinginthewarroom.com, where you can listen to episodes and you could share them with friends, like people who don't believe in climate change. Send this podcast to them. I'm sure I've convinced them in this class. 20 minutes.
And I'm Dave Gonzalez. You can find me on Twitter at DA7E. You can also find me on the Storm, a Lost Rewatch podcast with, once again, who forgot to plug himself, Matt Patches.
Talking
about the episode Special, which is a Walt and Michael episode. It also involves a polar bear. You know, it's, I don't know if you guys know what Lost
parenting
is.
Heavy.
It is. Okay, it is a parenting heavy episode.
Am I gonna think more highly of Walt on a rewatch as a parent?
More of Michael, yeah.
No, definitely more Michael.
Yeah.
Sure. I always liked Michael, okay.
Anyway, you can find that wherever fine podcasts are distributed.
I'm Katie Rich. You can find me at VanityFair.com on the Little Gold Men podcast, where I'm kicking off the Little Gold Men book club series with Joanna Robinson. You all talk to us about how much you like her. And remember, we have a podcast together, and we're talking about Little Women this week with the editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair, Radhika Jones, which is wild. She volunteered to be on the show. It was really exciting. So listen
Little
to that.
Gold Women.
Yeah, Little Gold Women is what we were calling it in our emails to each other. What a phenomenal pun that is. You can find me on Twitter at Katie Rich, KATEYRICH. And we're all on Twitter at FITWR, where what did you ask people to cast? The Steven Universe movie?
Yeah.
Do that, or answer your own answer to this week's Lightning Round question, which was,
in honor of Dora and the Lost City of Gold, what animated children's show that hasn't had a live action adaptation yet needs one?
Thanks for listening, and we'll be back talking to you next week.